This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The following wrestling exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 30 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winston, and today, to complete the Fortnight of Funk, which I extended for an extra week, realizing that I can fit three episodes in a two-week span, or really just a cheap excuse to cover Tuesday Night Titans, or TNT, as it was known at this time, because it was no longer airing on Tuesdays. I'll get into that momentarily. The episode is episode 46 on your WWE Network, also available on the YouTubes at this time, from August 16th, 1985. But first, I want to get in a few plugs, just right off the bat here. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. You can reach me on the Twitter and read any footnotes that I have on episodes, and sometimes I weigh in on what I'm watching at the time. For whatever reason, I decided to watch the November 1983 Philadelphia Spectrum house show, which is on the network and is a complete and utter train wreck on numerous levels, starting with Dick Graham paired with Gorilla Monsoon, where Dick, he loses his oeuvre when Kyle Rudman isn't sitting next to him, and Monsoon is just at his worst on those early Philly Spectrum shows. He didn't really add a lot in terms of his commentary at that time, and the matches are just really, really poor. And WWF 83, what a shock that is. So yes, on the Twitter, they're at GF Allentown Pod. Facebook, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown will take you to my page or whatever. And you may be listening to this show, you are probably listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, as tangentially involved with Place to Be Nation. And go to placetobenation.com to make your Amazon purchases, placetobenation.com/Amazon. And there are some interesting articles on placetobenation.com, one of which I'm going to call special attention to. It was written by Jason Greenhouse. It's entitled Writing Wrestling History, Survivor Series 1986. You're probably wondering, well, there was no Survivor Series until 1987. Well, that's the point. It is a thought exercise projecting what a Survivor Series card would have looked like had they started it a year earlier on Thanksgiving. Of course, they had no reason to, because Starrcade 86 wasn't on pay-per-view and there was no reason to screw with the Crockett's. But it was a very fun read to go through and imagine a Tito Santana captain team versus a Macho Man captain team. Some of the matches were better than others. Of course, you have Hogan Orndorff as your main event on that show, which would have taken place in Springfield, Massachusetts. And there was a rhyme and a reason for how Jason came up with Springfield as the site there. Now, as for me, I can sneak in a plug for my own blog, section309.com, which I should plug a little bit more, but I should also write there a little bit more frequently. A couple of years, actually, it was only a year and a half ago, as I was going through the Saturday night main events, similar to what Jason is doing with the Place to Be podcast, because they are in late 1986 at this time, I wrote an article projecting what SummerSlam 1987 would have looked like, and trying to factor in guys who were on hiatus at the time, what the feuds were, all that sort of stuff. My main event might be a little controversial when you read the article, but you can check it out at section309.com, or you can just Google SummerSlam 1987. I think it's actually one of the first results, because it's just weird enough that it would show up, because these are original ideas that we're having, both I and Place to Be Nation. So do check all that out when you get a chance. Now, Tuesday Night Titans here. This show was started in May of 1984, just another two-hour show to tack on to WWF programming, which was just expanding. It felt like at a rapid rate. You had All-American Wrestling starting up as the first show on the USA Network in late 1983, so they gave them another 2 hours in mid-1984. And that 2 hours proved to be a bit too much, because on Tuesday Night Titans, the highs were very high. There were very memorable segments, including one on the show I'm covering today. But there was also a lot of crap to wade through. On the Place to Be Nation, they were doing the WWE Network adventure, where they were going chronologically through everything that was posted on the network. And when it came to Tuesday Night Titans in 1984, it broke the will of a lot of the people writing as part of that, because there's a lot to slog through. I've watched a lot of 1984 Tuesday Night Titans, and you have, you know, mildly entertaining stuff, but no, it's just too long as a two-hour show. I know a WWF or E show on the USA Network that is 1 hour too long, I can't imagine that would ever happen again. Luckily, USA never made that mistake again, right? Oh, boy. There's a lot to get through, and it was in January of 1985 that the show was shortened to 1 hour. And mercifully so, because it becomes a much better show in 1985, where I've done most of my recent watching. And there is still some bad stuff, like when they're hanging out with Uncle Elmer in the barnyard, and Uncle Elmer is really just the shits of professional. I think he might be like the worst. If we ever do a worst wrestler ever project for WWE, in contrast to the greatest wrestler ever that is now going on at Place to Be Nation, I think Uncle Elmer may run away from that, because in all categories, he ranks as a zero. He had zero going on the Tuesday Night Titans that I saw him on. Now, by that point, it had been shortened to TNT, because if they're making it a one-hour show at the beginning of 1985, starting on January 4th, the show was moved to Friday. And in its place on Tuesday, they had added a new show called Prime Time Wrestling. So they kind of run into the Bill Simmons problem. You may recall Bill Simmons, who used to be famous on ESPN.com, less so now at HBO, had a show called Any Given Wednesday, which really bombed. I think it only lasted about 10 or 11 episodes. But when you name a show Any Given Wednesday, it kind of makes it so that you can't move off of that one date, which was part of the reason why it got canceled so quickly. And here with Tuesday Night Titans, and in the Titans part of it is, of course, a reference to Titan Sports, the parent company of the World Wrestling Federation at that time. And it's interesting that it got shortened to TNT, given that its main competitor a decade later, WCW Monday Nitro, would air on a network called TNT. Again, just another one of those great coincidences that would happen in wrestling history. So the show lasted through 1986. It kind of ran its course by the middle of that year, and near the end, Vince McMahon had dropped the hosting duties and let Mean Gene Okerlund kind of arrange for the funeral and all that for the final 12 or 13 shows. By September, when the show went off the air, the WWF had revamped their television. Championship Wrestling had become Superstars. All-Star Wrestling had become Wrestling Challenge. So there was definite change in the air. So yes, this is Vince McMahon cosplaying Johnny Carson, Jay Leno. Basically, The Tonight Show is what Vince McMahon is doing here. Couple of years after he was doing the Howard Cosell thing on a weekly basis on TV, wearing the yellow canary blazer like he was ABC Sports or something like that. He's sitting behind a desk. It looks exactly like any late-night talk show you'd ever seen, interviewing the wrestlers, having human interest segments where Ivan Putski is going to sing folk songs, and that was pretty interminable. I've mentioned before the Sal Bellomo building a ship in a bottle, which didn't do much for Sal Bellomo's character, in my opinion. And of course, Dr. D. David Schultz showing off his gun collection and having one of the guns go off and Vince freaking out on the air, giving us a quick, tiny glimpse at the Mr. McMahon character from a decade or so after that, where he gets really, really mad at that happening. And there was plenty more, like I said. The highs were very high on this show. When it was good, it was pretty damn good. But there was a lot of lows to sort through on TNT or Tuesday Night Titans. The theme song that I played here at the beginning is rather interesting in that it seems like there are three different ones that I'm encountering. You have the original theme song, which is actually a song by Herb Alpert, entitled 1980. So on the list of songs that are that are just names of years, I'm thinking 1985 by Bowling for Soup, 1984 by David Bowie, 2112 by Rush, if you have time to listen to that song at 23 minutes or however long it is. So 1980 by Herb Alpert, a song that was actually originally commissioned by NBC sports executive Don Ohlmeyer, who would go on to greater fame in pop culture later on as being a friend of O.J. Simpson and then firing Norm MacDonald from Saturday Night Live because Norm was making too many O.J. jokes, and Don didn't like the fact that Norm was making fun of O.J. in spite of the fact that he probably killed two people in 1994. He had commissioned that song to be made so that NBC could use it for its coverage of the 1980 Summer Olympics. Of course, the United States boycotted the 1980 Summer Olympics in Moscow, so the coverage, when they had about 165 hours or so planned, which is this huge thing, and ABC usually televised the Olympics, so it was very rare for NBC to get a shot at this. And they scaled it back to only a couple of hours because there was no U.S. involvement, so people really did not care about what was going on over in Moscow. Later on, NBC would use that song as their theme for the 1986 FIFA World Cup coverage, a World Cup that was won by Argentina due to the Hand of God play by Diego Maradona.
Maradona just walked away from Huddle then. They're appealing for offside. The ball came back off the foot of Steve Hodge, and Maradona gives Argentina the lead. The England players protesting to the referee.
Apologies to any listeners in England who might have been triggered by that just horrific call from the 1986 World Cup. I mean, not only did he hit the ball with his hand, but he was also offsides, and pretty clearly offsides at the time, and they still let the goal count. So Argentina ends up winning that World Cup in Mexico. How the hell did I get on the 1986? Oh, yes, of course, yes. Herb Alpert's 1980 used in NBC's coverage of the World Cup. And, of course, it was used on TNT here. But there, it seems like there are two overdubs on the network, one of which is the one that I played at the top of this show here. And then there is the one that plays as you open it up on the network, which feels like a different one than I played at the beginning of this show. I'm not entirely sure what's going on, but it's really kind of sending me into a tizzy because I like having the original music, but a lot of the overdubs are very much in the sound-alike vein, and that's a whole industry out there in the music world where, for like a commercial, you will commission a sound-alike that is just different enough that you don't run afoul of copyrights, but gives you the same feeling as the original song is. And I do like that last song that I just played, the one from the network. If I had to go with a permanent theme song for Greetings from Allentown, that would definitely be one of the contenders, along with the WWF on Nessun theme, which I pulled from one of the videos, thank God, shortly before it was taken off YouTube. So enough about music. Let me tell you what is on the show today. We have Corporal Kirshner, who is visited in the woods or in the jungle by Gene Okerlund, so they get a couple words with him. Tony Gurria, will be joining Vince McMahon. And what a ball of electricity that guy is. Straight out of New Zealand, indeed. Paul Orndorff will join Vince and discuss the bounty that was on his head for pretty much all of 1985. We get the Hart Foundation complete. Anvil, Hitman, and Jimmy Hart are on the show. And then a segment to close the show with Terry Funk in the Silver Bullet Saloon, I think it was called. Vince and Lord Al join Terry Funk for some drinks. It was not the Double Deuce, I know that. It was not the same bar from Roadhouse, although it might as well have been. Lord Al and Vince join him for drinks, and all hell breaks loose when somebody comes in and Terry does not approve of what he's doing. So why don't we just get right into the show? What I think was a real missed opportunity with this TNT show is that they didn't go all the way with the Tonight Show parody or tribute or what they were trying to do. They should have had Vince McMahon come out. You could have had Lord Al in the Ed McMahon role. And Vince comes out and he has to do a 7-minute monologue at the top of every show. That would have been great to hear Vince McMahon say, "Can you believe this weather we're having here on the East Coast, huh?" Could have done like the full Johnny Carson thing. That would have been great, even if he had done it just once. I would kill for that. And in researching this, you know, to do the little 3 seconds of Carson that I just did, I derailed myself by watching 15 minutes of Carson videos. So there we go. Carson, of course, a very complex man, just like Vince McMahon. It's a very good biography of Johnny Carson that came out several years ago by Henry Bushkin, who was his right-hand man for many, many years. I don't think you're going to get that about Vince McMahon, because, I mean, I read Pat Patterson's book, and he was not really willing to go into some of Vince's personal stuff, so to speak, the same way that Bushkin did in his book, which I believe came out in 2013, 2014, so it is definitely still in print. So Vince, with his usual wordier than it has to be intro for a new entry to the World Wrestling Federation, someone, of course, I talked about last week, Corporal, it's 420 somewhere, Kirshner, and Gene Okerlund is on assignment in a jungle or whatever, a dense and remote jungle that also somehow has trails, like open trails that are easy to follow and all that. So it throws to the videotape. Gene is trying to walk through with the cameraman through this dense jungle and finds Kirshner just sitting there smoking a joint, rolling a joint. Actually, no, he was holding a gun. And Kirshner explains that this is the last time that he will be holding this gun as he goes to prepare for his debut in the World Wrestling Federation. Well, sort of. I'll get into that later. And this is a fairly generic fare by the corporal.
"Mean Gene, you don't quit, do you? You followed me 12,000 feet in the air. You followed me through swamps. You followed me through jungles. I spent 2 months out here by myself, and all of a sudden, you show up, and you follow me all over the place. You got to be a determined man, Mean Gene. What's the story?"
I think Gene probably wanted to know what's going on with this ripoff of Sergeant Slaughter that we're slotting into the World Wrestling Federation now. Although he's not a complete ripoff. To be fair to Kirshner, he is Army 82nd Airborne Division, whereas Sergeant Slaughter, a Marine drill sergeant. Although I do think that this segment would have come off a little bit better had they just sent R. Lee Ermey from Full Metal Jacket. Now, granted, that movie did not come out for another couple of years, but wouldn't that have made this better, him just arguing with Kirshner?
"What's your excuse? Sir, excuse for what, sir?
I'm asking the fucking questions here, Private. Do you understand?
Sir, yes, sir.
Well, thank you very much. Can I be in charge for a while?
Sir, yes, sir.
Are you shook up? Are you nervous?
Sir, I am, sir.
Do I make you nervous?
Sir.
Sir, what? Are you about to call me an asshole?
Sir, no, sir.
How tall are you, Private?
Sir, 5'9", sir.
5'9"? I didn't know they stacked shit that high. You trying to squeeze an inch in on me somewhere, huh?
Sir, no, sir!
Bullshit, it looks to me like the best part of you ran down to crack your mama's ass and ended up as a brown stain on the mattress. I think you've been cheated."
Maybe such a moment like that would have shooken Kirshner up a bit, and he would have put his head on straight and flown right in the WWF instead of having a relatively short run that lasted in 1986, and he was gone by the middle of 1987, though he still had an LJN figure that I could have sworn that I had that LJN figure, but after rescuing them from my mother's house, that one is nowhere to be found. But I don't really care, just as long as Terry Funk and Roddy Piper and Junkyard Dog, those ones are still there, and of course my Special Delivery Jones figure. Right now, Vince McMahon welcomes his guest at this time, although he doesn't say my guest at this time, which of course is something that they make all the female interviewers say now when Seth Rollins walks on there and does his typical whiny promo that makes me want to change the channel. Tony Garea, legend of the Titans of Wrestling podcast and a favorite of the Our Vantage Point podcast, joining the show here. And Garea comes out with his flawless head of hair. When it comes to head of hair in WWE, if we ever have the greatest head of hair in WWE, Tony Garea is definitely a top five guy. He's certainly not going to be making the greatest wrestler ever list unless somebody is really focused on tag team workers. I'll get into Tony Garea's work in a little bit. But his hair looks really, really good. He's wearing a nice suit. And he acknowledges what I believe to be the non-existent crowd. It's just sort of piped in noise. So he kind of waves to the fake noise machine in Owings Mills, Maryland, which is a suburb of Baltimore, which is Video One is the name of the place where they did this show. They did Primetime Wrestling later on before they finally moved everything up to Stamford much later on. Tony Garea is one of those guys who always looked old. He always looked like he was about 47 years old. So in watching this, as he's, you know, blah, blah, blahing, I look up on Wikipedia. I say, how old was Tony Garea when this was filmed? And I see that he was 38 years old, the same age that I am now. And I immediately became very depressed and had to pause it as I realized I am the same age right now as Tony Garea was in 1985. I may not ever recover from this. So we start the interview here, and not exactly the greatest start in the world. We get the anecdote of New Zealand. See, Garea's, he had completely lost his way from his time as a tag team worker with Rick Martel, with Larry Zbysko in the late 70s. He had, as a singles worker, he was not very good, and also he was moving down the card at a pretty rapid pace. So how do we start out in this interview? We start talking about how sheep outnumber people in New Zealand, or so they say. Now, is his whole gimmick is that he's from New Zealand, but unlike the sheep herders, he's a babyface because he's generally non-offensive in what he's doing. As they're talking about the number of sheep in New Zealand, which would come up multiple times in this interview, Vince gets in a real cheap shot at Lord Al.
A little bit. There's approximately 60 million sheep down there, Vince.
Alfred, you'd be right at home.
And then they play footage of New Zealand there, just kind of showing the scenery and all that. See, it's much more than just Lord of the Rings filming locations. There's geysers and mineral springs. Although, to me, I would suggest going to Iceland for that sort of thing, because for most of the world, it is a much shorter flight. And I'm much more of an Iceland guy than I am a New Zealand guy. I never watched Lord of the Rings, so that really holds no appeal to me. And they show the mountains, and once again, Vince gets one over on Lord Al.
Inland waterway.
Is that snow?
That's snow on the southern.
No, Alfred, that's cotton on top of the hills up there.
This is so delightfully random, all the New Zealand stuff that they're showing. They're showing fishing. They show a jet boat, which Garea says was developed in New Zealand. And I checked that out, and that is actually true. So a historical thing being said on a wrestling program that turned out to be true. I'm very happy about that. Then they get into horses, and Vince lands another jab at Lord Al, saying, oh, I think that was your last date, Lord Al. And then they go into cricket, and a discussion of cricket, which Vince is completely baffled by cricket, a game similar to baseball, and also one that I've never quite understood. It's just sort of that game that the Indian guys in the town next to me play in the park when I'm watching my nephew play Little League. I don't understand any of the rules, and quite frankly, I don't think I ever will. And Vince, I don't know what kind of mood he was in filming this show. He must have been feeling his oats, I guess. Kind of accusing Gurria of maybe being a horn dog or something.
That was the game. Baseball is the game over here in America.
Mm-hmm. What other games were you? Well, I know from reputation you were playing a lot of games in New Zealand.
Al with the knowing laugh. I don't know what was going on there. I don't want to dig too deep into Tony Gurria's personal life because I'm quite frankly afraid of what I might find, given some of his comments on a previous Tuesday Night Titans appearance.
I have my eye on a couple of young boys, and hopefully if things work out, we can get together, and I'd like to try it for a sixth time. I'm sure you would.
Hey, he means going for the tag team titles, not anything else you might have discerned from what he was trying to say there. Anyway, they throw it to footage of him versus Jesse Ventura, and I thought to myself, this could be any number of different places in time. This could be 1982 from Ventura's run then. It could be 1984 from when Ventura had the blood clot issue. Or it could be from 1985. And yes, in fact, this is from the May 20th, 1985 Madison Square Garden show. And effectively, what we see is Tony Gurria having a boring-looking wrist lock on Ventura for much of the time that the footage is airing. Now, nobody specialized in eye maneuvers like eye rakes, eye gouges, eye anything, quite like Jesse Ventura did. So really, I don't know what you were going to see. And as I mentioned, Tony Gurria as a singles wrestler, by the time he was out of the tag division, he was kind of paired up with Eddie Gilbert in 1983. Eddie Gilbert left early 1984. He had the car accident the year before and really wasn't going anywhere. And Gurria was not teaming with anybody new at that point. And he was kind of jobbing and jobbing and jobbing. And he felt like he got broken at a certain point. And by 1986, where he's jobbing to like Harley Race on his way in. And that was one of the better Place to Be podcasts in there covering 1986. Scott Criscolo's rant about Tony Gurria being unprofessional and quote unquote sandbagging Harley Race in his MSG first appearance, at least in that run, was really, really hilarious and kind of sticks with me as, you know, a reminder of what Tony Gurria is. Although, truth be told, he wasn't as bad as he was late in his career. And as a tag worker, he was okay, although he always seemed to be the second guy in the tag team season. I mentioned Rick Martel and Larry Zbyszko. Well, both of those guys went on to have more celebrated careers, probably because they had youth on their side versus the older Gurria. We don't see the finish of Ventura versus Gurria, but Ventura won in 10 minutes 31 seconds with a elbow drop after Gurria hit the corner face first, so the SD Jones Memorial Charge. That match did appear, according to the history of WWE.com, on the Coliseum video, Best of the WWF Volume 19. I can't imagine what that made the cut over in order to make Best of WWF, because by Volume 19, they're really scraping the bottom of the barrel. It's a very interesting MSG show from May 20th, 1985. It only drew 15,000, but had both Hulk Hogan on the card, Hulk in the middle of the show right before intermission against the Magnificent Morocco. And your main event was Bruno and David Sammartino against Brutus Beefcake and Johnny V. So Bruno is main eventing in the Garden, and they don't sell out, and Hogan is also there as well. So I don't know, that would feel like a sure sellout in the spring of 1985, although maybe MSG was getting slightly little burned out there at that time, because you did have a show in February and then two shows in March, including WrestleMania. So they were running NMSG even more frequently than usual at that time. Vince asks Tony Gurria to stick around after the interview, and they'll be at the Silver Dollar Saloon, which going in there would not be a wise decision for Tony Garea, as we will come to find out.
Yeah? Are you nuts?
Bullshit.
A bounty. We could all end in the clinker for this.
Oh, big deal, Joe.
You can't put a bounty on a man's head.
I just did.
One of the bigger stories in the WWF throughout 1985 was the bounty placed on the head of Paul Orndorff by Bobby the Brain Heenan. $25,000. So that made Orndorff a marked man from the point where he fired the Brain, which actually occurred on Tuesday Night Titans shortly after the original WrestleMania. And Orndorff here is feeling quite good visiting with Vince. He feels that there's more electricity, or at least Vince says that there's more electricity in your matches now. And Orndorff says that life is good without the Brain. And looking at him and kind of evaluating Paul Orndorff, and I talked about him in episode 17, which was a later point in 1985. As a babyface world champion, he probably would have been a viable option because there were certain things going on at this time in 1985. For one, and this is all courtesy of the Between the Sheets podcast last week, which covered this time in 1985, around, I think, probably around the same week in August, talking about how Hulk Hogan had a knee injury, and had he gone in and had a surgery done, he might have been out for quite a while to the point where you would have had to get the belt off him. And with the WWF being the babyface promotion that it is, and was, and really isn't anymore, since they haven't booked an effective babyface in quite a while now, not since Daniel Bryan, and that was pretty much by accident. Paul Orndorff is probably your most viable world champion on the babyface side in this point, 1985, even though he's really only a babyface because you had to turn him that in order to turn him again to create the Hulk Hogan program the following year. You're not going to put the world title on the Junkyard Dog. That just wouldn't have worked. And Tito Santana didn't feel like he was at that level. And Orndorff is probably the most reasonable facsimile to Hulk Hogan that you could get, although certainly short on the charisma side, certainly short on the, you know, being personable side. Paul Orndorff, not exactly the most friendly veneer he's giving off. On the heel side, your most obvious option is probably Roddy Piper, because he had been there a year and a half. He had been your top heel for pretty much that entire time. But the problem was he was kind of looking maybe to get out and go back to Jim Crockett Promotions, that from the Between the Sheets podcast that I had just mentioned. Your other options would have been Randy Savage, who was completely brand new, too new at that point, not even really established. He is just getting Elizabeth as part of the package around this point in August. In fact, I don't think it took place until the week after this TNT aired. And another one that was speculated was, of course, Terry Funk, which would have certainly been interesting, although I see that more as a short-term transitional deal if you were going to do that. But the way they did it with Hogan, who decided not to have the surgery, again, was perfectly fine because it made the title reign being 4 years, it made perfect sense. And WrestleMania 3 doesn't have the same aura that it does without him having been the champion for 3 consecutive years up to that point. So talking about Hogan losing the belt, and I saw this on Twitter last week, that talking about Hogan dropping the belt to somebody at a particular point in time is kind of a fool's errand, especially if it's before WrestleMania 3, because the Andre program doesn't make sense unless he holds the belt for the 3 consecutive years up to that point. Now, they throw it to a match that Orndorff recently had against a masked wrestler. And this is one of the things I love about WWF TV in 1985. They were just not afraid to have masked jobbers on every single show. Like on episode 17, there were 3 different masked guys on the program. And this particular one is The Axe. Not to be confused with Axe from Demolition, who was a different guy, the masked superstar. This axe is actually, according to all research that I have been able to ascertain, is actually Corporal Kirshner under a hood. And the reason why I do believe that to be true is because the axe disappears from television at the point that Corporal Kirshner starts to appear and the vignettes start airing. You see the axe come in around May or June, and by early August, when the Kirshner stuff starts airing, you don't see the axe on television anymore. And they have a similar body type and all that. So it's kind of really strange to see kind of the real... He's like the mid-1980s WWF version of Jack Victory, except they're not using him in as many places as the NWA was using Victory in 1989. And this is just a quick squash, Orndorff with that typical intensity, with the big pile driver, but he doesn't get the pin because Roddy Piper has run in before the 1-2-3, and we get a wild brawl between Piper and Orndorff, very reminiscent of every Piper-Orndorff match that I've seen from the time period, where they really kind of made it look real. Where when they're fighting, it looks a little bit awkward. It doesn't look like a pro wrestling match per se. It looks like a fight. Heenan is at ringside during this, carrying a briefcase. I do like that the Brain was perfectly ready to pay out the bounty at all times. So if somebody had come up to him and said, yeah, I'm going to run in and I'm going to kick Orndorff's ass, could you come down with me with the briefcase and just be there to give it to me when I do put him out? And the Brain did that, even though Andre slams Stud at WrestleMania and then he runs in and grabs the money and all that. So they really made it look real. And also as part of this bounty hunting was Cowboy Bob Orton, who, of course, we all know is a veteran of the bounty hunting process. He actually joined in on this run-in because, of course, Bob Orton, 1983, in a probably more famous bounty angle against Ric Flair, where Harley Race had the bounty out on Ric Flair before Starrcade 1983, Orton and Dick Slater were looking to put Ric Flair out and were unable to do so. So yes, he is definitely a veteran of the process. And the babyface locker room clears out in order to break up this fight. And it's not even really like your big baby faces. You see like Mario Mancini out there to hold back Orndorff. Like, yeah, what is he going to do? Now, this bounty business is really driving Orndorff crazy. I'm not talking about paper towels. You know, this bounty, everybody is out to get him. He shows these broken fingers that he has, his ring and pinky finger. I don't know if that was legit or not, but he had kind of a splint or whatever on his hand, and he just says that he really just doesn't care anymore about whatever, and he gets up from his chair.
I don't care whether I or what I have to do. I don't care if I gotta hurt somebody. It's come to the point that I don't care anymore. Mr. Wonderful doesn't care anymore. I don't care what I have to do. Just bring them on one by one, and I'm still standing tall, Piper. I'm still standing tall, Heenan, and everybody else.
That would have been good if Phil Collins had made a video for that. Of course, that song came out several years before, but if they had re-released it with a video based on Paul Orndorff's interview here, that would have been fun. Vince makes an actual interesting point here that says that with a bounty on his head, his opponents would have different motivations than, say, a traditional wrestler in a wrestling match, where they're just out to hurt Orndorff to collect the bounty rather than to pin him 1-2-3. I thought that was very interesting of Vince to bring that up. We get more footage here, and this is a Piper-Orndorff match from the Cap Center in Landover, Maryland, which is now a shopping mall. In 1985, it was the home of the Washington Capitals and the Washington Bullets, before it was replaced in 1997 by the, I don't know what they're calling it now, but it was the Verizon Center and the MCI Center before that, and apparently it's changing its name for this upcoming NBA and NHL season, but anyway, that's not important. Paul Orndorff does a freaking enziguri in the clip of this match, which blew my freaking mind. I never would have expected Paul Orndorff to be doing that move. I just wrote "wow" in my notes here, and the two guys end up outside. And this is during an era, or this arena, the Cap Center was kind of not. It was a major arena, but it wasn't a major arena on the circuit. It wasn't on the level of the Philly Spectrum or Madison Square Garden or really even the Boston Garden. It was kind of just a notch below all those. This card was taped for Primetime Wrestling, which is why they have the footage of this. This didn't air on Primetime Wrestling. There are tables everywhere out on the floor. It's like, I don't know why they needed so many of them there, but it comes in handy as Mr. Wonderful shows that he could have lived in ECW in the 1990s as he swings a table and hits Piper with it. No, he doesn't swing a chair. He swings the entire freaking table. And boy, that definitely fits in with my time-traveling Paul Orndorff that I talked about many episodes ago, where I would love to take Paul Orndorff from that era and transport him into a more modern era, because that certainly would have worked. Back in the ring, you get a vertical suplex by Orndorff, but Piper gets his feet on the rope to prevent the pin. But I'm struck by one thing. There's a guy at ringside. I love watching the fans at ringside just to kind of gauge the reaction of the time and see what they're doing. They're not looking at their cell phones because it's 1985. There's some dude in a white shirt watching this great match, this crazy brawl between Roddy Piper and Paul Orndorff, who just has his arms crossed with like no expression on his face. Like, when I go to wrestling, I generally don't have much of a reaction to stuff. I'm almost like a Japanese fan, I guess, in that sort of way. But that guy, Jesus, could you at least appreciate what you're watching here? This is some classic stuff. 20 years from now, you're going to be wishing that these two guys were out there. Anyway, that match did end in a double countout, which was customary in the Orndorff-Piper feud. One guy really wasn't going to get over on the other. But I'll tell you, if I saw one of those matches live, from what I've seen, I sure as hell wouldn't have felt cheated by a double countout finish. In fact, I would have been coming back for more if they had done a rematch at my local arena. Yeah, back to Vince with Orndorff, and it's very serious in the kind of a more serious tone of like, I'm trying to put Piper out, and that he likes a fight. And as I said, you know, these matches with Piper looked like actual fights. They didn't look like natural wrestling matches. They had a sense of authenticity to them. Vince asks if Orndorff is bitter. And Orndorff is kind of like, well, yeah, none of this was my fault. I mean, Hogan got out of the way of the cast at WrestleMania 1, and it was Orton who ended up hitting him with it. So really, Orndorff doesn't feel like he has any culpability in this. And at this point watching this, Orndorff is very good in this segment. But then I thought, you know who would have been a great guest on Tuesday Night Titans TNT at some point along the line? Bad News Brown. If this was around in the late 1980s, Bad News Brown, who had one of my favorite wrestler appearances on the Arsenio Hall show, it is on YouTube, it is fantastic. Arsenio has a great back and forth with him, and Hall almost got Bad News to break character, which would have been a real accomplishment. I think it's about 5 minutes into the video where Arsenio has some sort of wisecrack back at something that Bad News said, who's, by the way, completely, deeply in that Bad News character. And that's a great video. Go check that one out. Yeah, he would have been a great TNT guest, but so was Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff in the heart of his run as a babyface.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com. And we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available on PlacetoBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacetoBeNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacetoBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Not included in the ad break is these For Your Consideration podcasts that I've mentioned in prior shows, but definitely you should listen to those because you probably will learn something. And I know I have. So, right now we have the Hart Foundation with Jimmy Hart as the next guests. And they come out, and I was very interested to see who was going to sit in the lead chair next to Vince. And it is the Anvil, Jim Neidhart, who takes the lead chair. Brett is wearing cowboy boots here, so I guess he, you know, didn't want a cowboy gimmick, but he's okay with wearing the cowboy boots on TV. Jimmy Hart has a magazine, and he says you can get it at any magazine store in the world, to which it made me think of the fact that in my hometown of Woburn, Massachusetts, there was a magazine store down in the center of town called Moore and Parker, I think it was called. Anyway, it had been a while since I've been there. It only closed, apparently, for good this past week, my mother informed me. I was very sad because that is where I used to buy Pro Wrestling Illustrated and other wrestling magazines when I was a young lad. Anyway, he holds up the magazine. It's got pictures of the Hart Foundation with little hearts around them. So, very nice. Even though Hart was with another one of his wrestlers in his photo, he had solo photos of the Anvil and the Hitman. And they say that they are going for the tag team titles currently held by the U.S. Express. But that would not be for long, as on Saturday the 24th at the Philadelphia Spectrum, the dream team of Brutus Beefcake and Greg Valentine would beat them for the tag title. So out the window goes the Hart Foundation's hope, since there wasn't going to be a heel versus heel program at that time. Although a good program, the Hart Foundation versus the U.S. Express would have been at least the version of Mike Rotundo and Barry Windham, though Barry Windham was kind of tired of the schedule or just doing Barry Windham flakiness sort of things. So he wanted out, so they had to get the titles off them and onto Valentine, giving him something new to do after losing the Intercontinental title recently to Tito Santana, and to at least elevate Brutus Beefcake somewhat as a friend of Hogan. Beefcake wasn't so bad in that dream team with Valentine, in my opinion anyway, but they busted him out of there at the right time in 87. So the Harts were not really a pushed commodity in 85 and up through 86, they would break them out into singles matches all the time. And that would be a good thing in the case of Bret Hart, because you would get matches like Bret versus Steamboat at the Boston Garden from March of 86. And some, you know, some other matches that I could probably name but are slipping my mind. And with the Anvil, you would get these just boring 20-minute draws, him versus Brian Blair. A boring Brian Blair match. I can't believe it. Yeah, so when they would split, the Anvil was kind of left to his own devices. He was the Tony Garea of the team, if you will. Not quite as successful in singles as he was in the tag team with Bret. As for Bret, at this time, he was kind of trapped in the same way that his brother Owen would be in 1991 and 92. Even though Owen was a babyface at that time, I still think that they saw Bret as, yeah, he's a good worker, he's a good technician and all that, but why should we push him when he's so incredibly useful in putting over bigger babyfaces at the time, like a Ricky Steamboat, when he's effective in that role? So he's kind of stuck in a sort of no man's land that it took Owen Hart, took a heel turn for him to really break out of. And they throw it to a tag match that had been on one of the weekly shows. It's the Harts versus Joe Murto and George Wells, a couple of football players, although alleged in Joe Murto's case, because in an early episode I could not figure out if he had played for the Miami Dolphins in the late 60s or not. I'm assuming not, although Joe Murto seems like a different enough name that it was him. George Wells, of course, was a star in the Canadian Football League and was forever kind of a jobber to the stars and the guy who would make me go, huh? When I would watch the tape of WrestleMania 2 and his match with Jake Roberts would come up, I would always be very confused because I would never see George Wells on any other tape as a kid. It was literally my only exposure to the guy. And his tights really looked like football pants, but without the leg pads in them. It was really kind of weird. When they go to the clip, they show a fan in the front row with a sign that says, Neidhart's head resembles an anvil. By the way, Neidhart is spelled wrong in that. And yes, just another one of those sick burns by the WWF fans of the mid-1980s. There are some just weird signs that you would just see in audiences at that time that were just very simple. Just, you know, stuff like that. The Anvil screws up the usual Hart Foundation transition move, which is the knee in the back off an Irish whip. Bret was a master at that, which is probably why Bret had to be the guy on the apron to do it, because the Anvil screwed it up here. And Wells ends up ramming them together, because Wells was the guy in the ring, and he gets a lot of offense from the little clip that we have here, and is kind of in control. And then he tags in Joe Murto. Murto, of course, being one of the great enhancement talents at the time that you would see time and time again on the weekly TV. The Harts do the demolition decapitation move, which was weird in that they would continue doing that even when Demolition was in the promotion and had it as their finisher. And when I was a kid, I thought that was a little strange that they were doing the same move, but I kind of explained it to myself like, well, Axe is a much bigger guy coming off the rope, so it has a lot more impact than Bret, who comes in straight on and is about 70 pounds lighter than Axe. They set up for the Heart Attack finisher, and I've said many times how much I love this move because of the way Bret would throw himself into it, but there was a little twist here as the Anvil gave Murto an Irish whip and caught him off the whip there, and then Hart came in with the clothesline. So it was a nice little added element, a lot of moving pieces there. Vince, back in the talk show segment, calls out Jimmy Hart for his use of the megaphone, which he defends as just trying to get instructions to his men. The Anvil weighs in with something rather interesting. He... Let me just play it and just imagine the Anvil of 1985 being exposed to today's internet.
You know, let me say one thing. You know, since the WWF is so popular across the United States, all of a sudden, everyone is an expert on professional wrestling. You know that, Jimmy?
Right, that's right.
He'd say, what about the horn? What about this? What about tactics? Everyone is an expert, right, Brett?
That's right. Everybody's an expert.
A know-it-all.
All right, perhaps. Certainly everyone's entitled to their view.
Oh, and everyone seems to have one.
Right?
Doctors come on TV, start saying things about professional wrestling, this and that. What about the horn? Hey, we're the pros. We're the experts, right, Jimmy?
You're an expert?
No, it was on the replay.
So you're an expert?
No, it was on the replay.
So you saw it, you're saying, yes. You saw it, it's on, you're an expert?
Yes.
All right, that is the most obscure, that last part there. That's going to be the most obscure sound clip that I ever play on this show. So anybody who comes to me via Twitter or Facebook and can identify what that is in reference to, who is saying that whole expert business at the end, I'll give them a shout out by name on the next show. But yeah, Anvil, just wait until the internet comes along, because then and only then will everybody truly be an expert. Brett explains the megaphone by saying that the crowds are so loud at WWF events that it's needed in order for those instructions to get through. So he's really just kind of reiterating what Jimmy Hart says, thereby reminding us why Bret Hart needed a mouthpiece for so long. This segment was okay. They don't really do much with it. It's fine, but it just kind of makes clear that Bret doesn't have a real personality yet. That's why sometimes they would spell it with two T's instead of with one T, because Brett just really wasn't enough of a guy to speak up about it. It's all right, sometimes that's what it takes. You're only human, you're allowed to make your share of mistakes. Only human. Now for the reason why I would pick this show as part of the Terry Funk fortnight of funk. He's hanging out at a bar that is not the Double Deuce. It is the Silver Bullet Saloon, as they put it. And he's just sitting at the table with a beer and his chaw, playing cards, probably solitaire or something. It's really weird to think of Terry Funk playing solitaire, but it is what it is. And Lord Al and Vince McMahon arrive at the door, and it is a scene reminiscent out of Animal House when the Deltas show up at the bar to see Otis Day and the Knights, and everybody in the bar, everything stops, and there's a record screech, and they look at him. Well, this is slightly different, but Terry makes sure to give them a nice warm welcome.
Mr. Funk!
A Yankee dude and a British pervert.
Now, Vince is wearing a suit. It's a plaid suit, but it's not too outlandish. It's not super dark plaid where everything is heavily contrasted with each other. And Lord Al is wearing his usual tuxedo, so he's really not dressed for a Wild West saloon, which is the whole motif here. When Vince asks Terry if everybody there is a friend of his, Terry says that all cowboys are his friends. I wonder if that also includes Ezekiel Elliott. Any offense. So Terry now goes in and kind of tells a bit of a joke. And the joke doesn't go so well, but he makes sure that everybody else in the bar will give him a hearty laugh.
Do you know the difference between a Texas Brandon and a WWF Brandon? In Texas, we brand cattle. And in the WWF, we brand jackasses! Laugh! Laugh! Shut up!
This is so amazing that Terry Funk is like the governor or president of this bar here, and he has to cajole everybody to laugh at his joke, but then when they laugh a little bit too long, he all of a sudden turns into Sid Vicious or Psycho Sid and shut up! It's just so great, and one of the reasons why I had to pick this random episode of TNT. So they throw it to a clip of a match, and it is done with the promise that they will show Terry Funk branding somebody. So we go to All-Star Wrestling from July 20th, 1985, And this is actually noticeable. We have the commentary, the commentary team of Jack Reynolds and Jesse the Body Ventura, the original hosts of Primetime Wrestling when it premiered in January of 1985. This is actually, I believe, the last episode for Jack Reynolds. So this is more or less the last you would hear of him on WWF television. Of course, I immortalized him in episode 9, as he called Maple Leaf Wrestling in October of 1984, alongside the great Angelo Mosca. And this match between Terry Funk and Paul Roma is a pretty short one, but fairly memorable. It starts out with some stiff slaps, with Funk getting in the first one, and then Roma doesn't break clean against the ropes and gives Terry a slap of his own, and then manages to get in the third one as well. So Paul Roma here, he's not wearing knee pads, which, I don't know, kind of bothers me a bit, because he looks slightly different than what we would become accustomed to later on with the Young Stallions and Power and Glory. He's, at that time in 1985, he is the heir to the throne. And I'm not talking about, you know, the King of Wrestling or any of that jibber jabber. I'm talking about the Rick McGraw super jobber throne of the undersized babyface who would lose all the time but would put up way more of an effort than anybody else. Of course, Rick McGraw passed away a couple of months later, and Paul Roma would slip nice and easy into that role, at least until the Young Stallions got a slight itty-bitty push in 1987. Terry is yelling, "Get up, pig," and Jesse can't understand what the Funker is saying to him. He's just kind of beating the crap out of him, so maybe that's why Jesse couldn't hear it so well. You get three headbutts in a row by Terry Funk. It's kind of odd to see him using the straight-on headbutt there. Of course, that wouldn't work against JYD, because then you'd have Gorilla coming in, "Oh, he didn't do his homework, Jess!" Get an interesting sequence here. Body slam by Funk, then he tries to drop an elbow, and it misses. But he grabs Roma again, body slam, elbow misses again. He goes for another slam, and Roma counters it into a small package for two. So that was your near fall right there. And Funker takes control at this point and gets him up for a vertical suplex, but he adds a nice little twist to it, no pun intended. He actually does a spinning vertical suplex. And I thought, that is a really cool move. Why doesn't somebody do that now? Of course, you don't really see vertical suplexes quite as much these days. That's something that Brock Lesnar could do. I mean, it is a suplex. It's part of Suplex City. It's like the rotating restaurant or something downtown. Whatever that's called. Spinnaker? I don't know. I like to play Sim City and create Suplex City there. It's only in operation like five times a year. That's the way that would work. It wasn't the prettiest looking move, but I admire the moxie there. And then he slaps on the spinning toe hold, or the Texas spinning toe hold, because it's bigger than other toe holds, is what I imagine happened here. And he picks up the submission victory over Paul Roma. A fun little match, not any longer than it needed to be. So they cut back, and they actually don't show the branding as promised. And Terry is extremely upset about this and gets even more upset when he finds out why.
Where's the branding? Where's the branding?
I thought that was a particularly distasteful act, and I took it upon myself to
they
cut
didn't
it out.
See the branding?
I cut it out.
Do you want me to brand you?
No, I don't.
Jackass!
Now, the thing that's funny about that is Vince throws it to commercial to try and gain control of the show again, is the image of Lord Alfred Hayes at the WWF headquarters, like in an edit bay watching this. He's in video bay number one. And he's like, "Oh, no. I'm going to cut out the branding because it is beneath the dignity of the World Wrestling Federation." Al cut it out by himself. But of course, there actually is a history between Lord Al and Terry Funk, or at least the Funk family, dating to the early 1970s. And this is a very interesting thing that I found out in my research from when Dory Funk Jr. was the NWA World Champion. You have Lord Al challenging for that title, and they did a dusty finish of sorts well before that became something that was known by that term, where Lord Al, or Judo Al Hayes, as he was known for much of his wrestling days, defeated Dory Funk Jr. for the NWA World Heavyweight title, and then it was reversed after the match due to the referee getting beat up after the match had already happened. So it was really kind of a BS sort of finish there. Couldn't find any video on that. In fact, I don't know if I've ever actually seen video of Al Hayes in action. I know there's stuff of him doing promos in the early 80s down in Florida before he had come to the WWF. So now there's some tension there between Hayes and Funk. And Hayes, like, he goes after Terry's family, which I feel like is not the best idea in a barroom, saloon type setting where Terry is clearly surrounded by all of his people.
Mr. Funk, I don't know anyone in professional wrestling that has an attitude like you. I don't know a single soul who has an attitude quite like yours.
Alfred, because I'm middle-aged and crazy, crazy like a fox. Is there anything wrong with that attitude?
Well, you have
Mr. Hayes.
You have no dignity.
You jackass.
Please, don't demean Alfred. Alfred's a nice guy. Don't you know Alfred?
He knows me. I know him, too, and he's always been the same. He'll never change.
What's wrong with me?
Your whole family was the same.
It's kind of contradictory in that Vince is saying, Alfred's a nice guy, and Alfred is, like, personally attacking this guy's family. Now, of course, if he has prior history, that's one thing, but he shouldn't go all in on him when clearly this is a tense situation there at the table. And when you have a tense situation like that, what do you need? You need Tony Garea walking into the bar at this time to join them, as he was invited earlier in the show. So Tony and Tony Garea's hair, who are completely separate entities, because Garea's hair is a thing unto itself. I'm not saying he's wearing a wig or anything. I'm just saying that coif, of that head of hair that 19-year-olds would covet, sits down at the table there, and Terry orders some beers, just kind of shouts out to the woman in the red dress, who is a very low-cut dress. She's kind of revealing everything she's got there. And the beer that she serves is not particularly well done. There's a lot of head on the draft beer that is given over. And this is actual beer. And I'll get to that momentarily. So they're talking about the environment there and how it's different from New Zealand. And Garea says, oh, I've been in more than a few good environments. And then when he sees the waitress, like, oh, and this one just got a little bit better. So Garea, as if to dispel rumors of his sexuality based on his prior appearance on Tuesday Night Titans.
I have my eye on a couple of young boys, and hopefully if things work out, we can get together and...
Starts macking it but good to this waitress. And Vince is trying to have a conversation with Terry Funk, because this is Terry's segment, and Garea has kind of, you know, taken it upon himself to crash the scene here, although he was invited by Vince. So he's talking to the waitress there, effectively trying to get in what is left of that red dress she has. And the conversation between Terry and Vince is very awkward, and Funk is distracted by this. Although we learn that Terry Funk, I don't know if this is real Terry Funk or if it's Terry Funk, the WWF character, we find out that he minored in geography as they're having a discussion of New Zealand versus Texas. And eventually, Garea and the waitress get up. Garea gets up from his seat and joins the waitress at the bar area. And Funk just starts ignoring Vince and whatever he's saying and decides to pound the rest of his beer. And he grabs a bottle. He makes his way up to the bar and he grabs a bottle. I don't know if it was of beer or whiskey or whatever it was. And this is the show image for this week. Usually I like to create a different show image for my feed and for the Pro Wrestling Only feed. In this case, I'm going to make an exception because this is like the Last Supper of all the show images that I've come up with on Greetings from Allentown. I am actually looking at that picture right now and I'm staring at it in much the same way that Cameron stares at that painting for a really long time in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Here's what's going on here. You have Gurria talking to the waitress. He's got his left hand on her right shoulder, so he's laying it in pretty good. But I also notice on Gurria's left hand, there's a ring. So I'm wondering, is Tony Gurria married and he's going after this waitress? So who knows what that is? It could be, you know, a ring of whatever for being a five-time WWF tag team champion with five different partners. You have Lord Al sitting in the chair doing nothing, just kind of watching what is going on, like with no reaction. You only see like the back of his head. Vince, you can barely see. You can only see his right shoulder of his suit. And Terry Funk has the bottle, which I can now see is definitely a beer bottle because of the way that it is shaped. And he has it in his left hand. It's not, he hasn't broken it yet or anything, but he's holding it like he's winding up to hit Gurria in the back of the head. So Lord Al, who starts all that stuff with Funk earlier, does nothing to stop what turns into a complete melee here as he breaks the bottle over the back of Tony Gurria's head. And Lord Al and Vince, they flee the premises. They just get out of there so that Terry can do his thing. He breaks a chair, slams Gurria into a table, smashes a whole bunch more crap on him. There was one point where he threw the chair and it looked like it definitely missed and hit the bar, but it was still funny. And Terry kind of slips because it's getting slippery there. It almost looks like the Nasty Boys versus whatever that match was, the concession stand brawl from, I think it was Spring Stampede 94, because he had trouble getting his footing with the cowboy boots there. And it's just a total mess in there. And he does the Terry Funk thing of tossing chairs and gets Gurria up and just measures him with a left hand and grabs him by the tie and yells at him, but good. And there is no Dalton or Wade Garrett around to stop Terry Funk. This is his bar. And this is all just so magnificent. There's something for everybody here. For the people who don't like Tony Gurria, for the people who like Terry Funk, for the people who like Tony Gurria's hair, for people who like barroom brawl action, Terry Funk throwing chairs, Lord Al just being a complete dick to Terry Funk, quite frankly, and Vince trying to hold it all together in the middle. Just a magnificent segment all the way around. And they go to an ad break after Terry is done with Gurria. And Vince and Lord Al, they're standing in the rubble of everything. There's a guy trying to clean up, but they've got to shoot the final segment here of TNT. And Al, he went back and grabbed his like the shard of his drink to demonstrate that Al, a man has gotten beaten up and got hit with a bottle multiple times. But Lord Al, all he can think about is he can't have the rest of his beer because he took like the glass and then he dropped it on the floor. So Al's got his priorities in the right place. He calls the actions of Funk cowardly. And they break it down very much like a post-game show after like any sort of sporting event. Vince is like, everybody was cheering for Terry here in this bar. And like, I don't know, I felt like they were going to have like a sponsored segment. Player of the game obviously would have been Terry Funk in this case. And they close it out and credits roll. And Vince and Hayes, they totally half-ass helping to clean up. They're doing that thing, the credits roll, the music's playing, and you know they're still kind of moving around. It's like that thing on Jeopardy where the contestants are talking to Alex Trebek at the end of the show, and you don't know what they're saying, but you can see everything that's going on. Vince and Lord Al are doing like the most half-assed help on the cleanup. And this is when we learn in the credits here, the beer was courtesy of Anheuser-Busch. So it was probably Busch beer, which was big in the mid-80s, or at least in my memory. I remember seeing a lot more commercials for that. Or Budweiser, Bud Light, something like that. Which is interesting in that you're at the Silver Bullet Saloon. So the Silver Bullet is Coors Light. But it's Anheuser-Busch actually sponsoring the segment. I bet you they didn't even know what the WWF was going to call that segment. And that is how they wrap this episode of TNT for August 16th, 1985. But we still have one segment to go here, and it is another exciting edition of YouTube Comment Theater. Now, despite the fact that this is on a fairly popular channel out there, there's only 5 comments on this video right now. It was only posted to YouTube back in June. So this isn't going to take very long here. It's not going to be the Extendo edition like we had with Saturday Night's Main Event last week. Chang T says, "Who the fuck is this corporal guy?" And then there's a reply from Eric Arcieri. "The guy Vince used when Sergeant Slaughter left in typical Vince McMahon fashion, Kirshner wasn't bad, though." Okay, first of all, commas and periods are your friend there, Eric. But yes, Kirshner, of course, being the Sergeant Slaughter guy. But as I said, it's Marines versus Army, so it's not a complete copy. It's not like he was Terry Daniels, who was also a Marine, like Slaughter. Of course, Daniels was the first member of the Cobra Corps, which they played up for like 2 months, and then nothing really happened with it. But to say that Kirshner was good during this time period, yeah, I'm going to have to go ahead and sort of disagree with you there. Drew Kane says, "Terry Funk versus Paul Roma in one of the WWF's stiffest matches of the 1980s. Great match." I don't know if it was great. I don't think it was really long enough to really blossom into great territory. It was only about a 4-minute match or so, but it was a lot of fun, and that's why Roma got the Rick McGraw super jobber spot, is that he was very good at that role that they were asking him to do. There's a lot made fun of Paul Roma because he ended up becoming a horseman, which isn't entirely his fault. He was still, I think he was very good at what his role was in the 80s, and Power and Glory was a pretty good team. It's just, you know, you can't ask the guy to do too much. He was never going to be a top guy. Not everybody can be that. Shy Mirror says, "Did they make you take down the 93 WCW episode? Sure is random how they determined that." And yeah, this has been a running thing on Greetings from Allentown. I have no idea how they determine what stays and what. I've gone over it several times in the past, and then I'm immediately proven wrong 2 weeks later when something happens. So we'll just sit down and pray and hope all this stuff stays up there. And then finally, Frank Piccirillo says, "Vince and Lord seemed so relieved when Tony Garea showed up at the saloon, LOL." And yes, I will say that there hasn't been anybody in history that has been so happy to see Tony Garea walk into a bar as Lord Al and Vince were at that very moment. And that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. As for next week's show, I haven't quite decided yet. I've been very busy through the Labor Day weekend here, and I haven't been able to watch as much wrestling as I would like, but of course I always forget that on YouTube I have this lengthy queue built up of things that have struck my interest over time that I watched a while ago, and now I need to go back and rewatch for the purposes of the show. So follow me on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod, or on Facebook at facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. I will probably post something around Sunday-ish, because I can almost guarantee that with the NFL season starting, I'll be recording as I'm watching the Red Zone channel on Sunday afternoon. I feel like that's a routine that I could greatly become accustomed to. Of course, I should share my brilliant NFL wins pool. Of course, it's probably too late for anybody to put one of these together in time. Although week one, all the teams play, so you could play it for just the last 16 weeks of the season. And this is something that I invented, and I'm quite proud of it. And I know this is a wrestling podcast, but please indulge me for a second. So you have 32 NFL teams, okay? So it's kind of a weird number, unless you can get 8 of them. But for me and 4 of my friends, we pick 6 teams. And you do a usual snake draft. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And then you go on and you end up picking 30 teams. But here is the catch. The teams are grouped into three categories according to preseason rankings and expectations. So the 10 best teams are up front, the middle 11 teams, and then the bottom 11 teams. And you have to pick two teams from each group. So the strategy is, well, sure, you could pick the Patriots, the Steelers, or the Seahawks, but what if Cincinnati is in the lowest group and you think they'll win 11 games? There's probably not too many teams in that bottom group that would win 11 games. So you're looking for the outlier in each group, and it's kind of a challenge. I've been doing this now for 4 or 5 years. In fact, the first one in 2013, which is the only time I've ever won, I awarded myself the World Heavyweight Championship. I bought one of the toy replica belts, and it's just sitting in my basement collecting dust now. It was like right before they merged the titles in that Orton-Cena match, so I should have just kept it in the box because I think the thing is worth $200 now. So yes, if you're going to do an NFL wins pool, you're going to have to hurry, but I do like my idea, and I probably should have spelled it out on the blog, where you pick two from the top, two from the middle, and two from the back end. And the beauty of it is you have one team in the middle and one team in the back end who is not going to be drafted. So you don't even have to pick the New York Jets. So nobody is going to get stuck with the New York Jets as they try to go 0-16 this year, or at least so it seems. So stay tuned to all the social media platforms. I will have a show next week. So do tune in next week for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Ah!